It's a word that's fallen out of favor, heathen, and yet it helps as few others to draw a line between the powerful concepts of us versus them. The concept drives much of modern religion as it has down through the ages and is reflected in much of the politics that religion influences. An insightful book exploring the history and impact of the idea, titled Heathen, Religion, and Race in American History, takes on this important topic. And I am happy to welcome its author, Dr. Catherine Jen Loom, to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me here.
As a scholar, I'm sure your choice of this word was carefully considered. So why heathen?
There's a couple reasons why I decided to write this book about the figure of the heathen in American history. So on the one side, there's personal reasons for the book, which was that I was raised in a conservative religious tradition, and I am myself Chinese American, and my family has origins in China. And as a child, I was raised Christian, and I was raised to believe that much of the rest of the world was heathen. And so for me, that meant that I had ancestors, I had relatives that I had never met in China that were likely heathen. And that was just something that I had a hard time wrapping my head around and understanding what that meant. I actually wrote my first book about hell. And so I guess you could say that I've been thinking about this, about damnation, salvation, who's saved, who's damned, you know, religious lines between the us versus them for a long time. Academically speaking, I guess I came to the topic way back when I was an undergraduate. Actually, I was writing a senior thesis on foreign missions in Gold Rush era California. Hmm. So looking at missionaries to the Chinese population. And in the 19th century, Chinese immigrants were derided as heathens. They became kind of the quintessential heathen population. And so I was really interested in what that meant. What did it mean for somebody to be called a heathen? And the thing about the category of heathen is that it is expansive, right? So it's not just the Chinese population, but you know, I came across a map in the course of my research that color-coded the world by religion. And the vast majority of the world was colored gray for heathen. And so it got me to wondering, you know, what does it mean that this category can cover people coming from China, people coming from the Hawaiian Islands, from, you know, just all over the world are encompassed in this category. So what does it include and what does it mean? And how does it shape the ways in which Euro-Americans view themselves and their place within the world?
My goodness, I identify with you so much because I think, as I remember my childhood, that anybody that wasn't a Baptist was a heathen.
Right.
So has the line always been drawn between heathens and Christians, or has it more often been what we see today, the quote-unquote right kinds of Christians and everybody else?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, over time, so the category of the heathen is this, as I said, it's very expansive, but over time, the category was kind of subdivided and divided into quote-unquote world religions. So mm-hmm. as Europeans and Euro-Americans began to understand more about the other people and their practices and traditions that they were encountering, they began to give labels to these other traditions. And so within the category of heathen, you get, you know, eventually like the understanding that there are Buddhists and Hindus, et cetera.
Sure.
But the category heathen is also really interesting because it was also used as a way to attack the wrong kind of Christian, as you say, right? So because the concept of the heathen was primarily associated with people who did religion wrong, it was a really useful polemical device to turn back on Christians mm-hmm. whom other Christians believed were doing religion wrong, right? And so then they would then associate what they saw those foreign heathens doing with what other Christians were doing and say, you know, how can you have these quote unquote heathen practices happening in our Christian land? So this is used for everything from like dancing and the wrong kind of worship music. Yeah. You know, the word heathen is applied to those things as well.
Right, right. So, Catherine, if you would, talk about the ways visible differences enable this kind of division.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the interesting thing with the concept of the heathen is that it's often thought to be a matter of internal belief. So it's not thought to be something that is visibly embodied necessarily. So a lot of scholars have actually looked at the emergence of race as a category of difference, and they've argued that the emergence of race actually happens after this idea of heathenism starts to wane, right? So heathenism is thought to be something that is internal. It's about your beliefs, your wrong beliefs. It can be converted away. Whereas race is often thought to be something that is embodied. It's thought to be inherent. You know, it's about the color of your skin and other things that are visible. But what I try to argue in the book is that actually heathenness is also an embodied category, right? Heathenness can be seen. And so the ways in which this occurs, so missionaries and Protestant Americans believe that wrong belief has ramifications on the body. So it's because people are worshiping idols or they're worshiping ancestors or spirits, you know, not the correct one and only true God, they are wasting their time, you know, devoting their energy in bodily penances and things like that, that they shouldn't be doing, rather than spending their time cultivating the land around them, developing new technology, et cetera. And so they begin to see heathen bodies as suffering, as sickly, as contorted or warped because of the penances that they are, incorrect penances that they are doing to the wrong kinds of deities. And so the heathen body becomes figured as, you know, the suffering person overseas who needs to be saved. And obviously there are many, many contemporary ramifications to that view of, you know, visible distress.
Does heathen always cross over into racism?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, I think it depends on how you define racism. Some people have understood racism to be primarily just a matter of personal prejudice. A lot of scholars disagree with that conception, and I mark myself among that number, that racism is about structures of discrimination, structures of governance that hold up one group of people as superior to all others, right? So as one of my scholarly mentors has put it, Sylvester Johnson, racism is a system of colonial governance that sets the European or the Euro-American above the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that the idea of the heathen basically depicts the heathen world as needy, right? The very idea of the heathen suggests that people marked as such need to be changed, need to be rescued or saved. Then yes, I think it is very much part of a system of racial governance.
Hmm.
And you can, you know, you can be sympathetic towards the heathen. You can have, you know, feelings of trying to help and still be performing that, you know, act of racial governance. Yeah. Absolutely.
So how does this heathening cross over from the other being the wrong kind of Christian to being the wrong kind of American?
So I'm going to answer that question by talking about the late 19th century and debates over Chinese exclusion, which I think have a lot of repercussions and ramifications today. So I spoke earlier about how the Chinese were considered to be quintessential heathens. That was used as an excuse to keep the Chinese out of the country. They were marked as un-American because they were heathen. And the reasons for this were the Chinese spent too much time devoted to worshiping their ancestors. And because they spent so much time worshiping their ancestors, they did not devote time developing their country. They did not develop technological innovation. So even though they were brought to the U.S. to work on the railroad, they were seen as not technologically advanced because they were just so stuck in the past. They were constantly looping backwards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Protestant America at the time viewed itself as a progressive civilization. Right? Protestantism was connected to technological development, that God, the Protestant God, was overseeing America's remarkable progress, right? This is seen as a country that is driving forward to the future. And so people who are heathens are stuck in the past. And because they're stuck in the past, for heathens to come to America and to bring their heathen forms of worship was seen as incredibly dangerous, that it could, you know, bring Americans back to a kind of stagnation, and it could keep Americans from this forward-moving development where they eventually become a kind of superpower in the world, right? So heathens are seen as holding that back. And so, you know, Americans believe that they have to go out into the world and save the heathens, but they don't necessarily want, quote unquote, heathens to come to the United States, which suggests something about the fragility of Americans' conception of themselves, right, as a Christian nation. If this supposedly Christian nation can be so easily swayed towards heathenism, you know, what does that say about American Christianity?
Can you think of a moment in history in which this tendency really flared up, and what the consequences of that were?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many moments in history when the tendency to depict others as heathens has flared up and has had severe consequences. I write in the book about how the category of the heathen has been used as almost as a get out of jail free ticket to excuse all manner of things in the name of saving the heathen. So enslavement, for instance, the idea that people of African descent were heathens, that was used as a justification for slavery. The removal of indigenous people, indigenous children, separation of indigenous children from their families, putting them into boarding schools, cutting off their hair, making them wear Western clothes, eat Western food. Recently the discovery of indigenous children's graves, that was justified in the name of eradicating heathenism. And in fact, there are some on the religious right today who have looked at instances of that happening and said, there was one article recently that came out, I think it was in the American Conservative, that said, well, you know, this was in the service of saving pagans, essentially. And so it becomes a get out of jail free ticket that really can excuse everything from murder to cultural genocide.
Yeah. Respecting the power and longevity of these tendencies, I can't help but wonder what it portends for long-term interfaith work. A small minority of us work to lower the wall between us and them, but a majority seems comfortable, dependent on having heathens to condemn and despise.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think, one of the things that I found most exciting in the course of my research was finding the people who pushed back against this category of the heathen. Some of them, people who were considered to be heathens themselves. Some actually took on the category for themselves and said, you know what, if you're going to call me this, I will claim that name for myself, and I will claim it as a badge of resistance to white American Protestantism. The heathen, actually, we know how to take care of the land. We get along better with other people. We're not exclusivist. We are not who you are. So yes, we are heathens. And other people, contested this category by trying to build interfaith dialogue, by trying to understand and argue that, this exclusivist way of seeing the world, such that a particular kind of Christianity is the only right way, is very problematic. And some of those people they identify as Christians, right? So they're trying to expand what Christianity means, who falls under the umbrella of Christianity. One of the groups that I consider in the book is the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians. And I look at a conference that they held in India, and there are participants who came to this conference, identifying as Christians, who basically toured New Delhi, where the conference was held. And in the process, they thought to themselves, the way that I have understood Christianity is just so narrow. And the way that I have thought about other faiths is so narrow. Now I'm seeing all this evidence of different forms of practice, different culture. And I want to understand how that can be included under my umbrella of what I think Christianity means.
All of this comes in a lot of antidotes, but let me ask you this. In your research and in what you have found, what will change this?
Wow, what will change this? Yeah, you know, I have to say that the book ends, honestly, on a kind of pessimistic note, because it essentially ends on the saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. In particular, looking at the COVID-19 pandemic and responses to the COVID-19 pandemic, which I see is like very much of a piece with how so-called heathens were denigrated in the past. You know, we might not use that word anymore, but the ways in which anti-Asian hate in particular have played out, you know, the people being scapegoated for supposedly unhealthy eating practices, you know, disease, and all of these things, like tying back to a wrong way of engaging with the world, like these things still persist. So yeah, what can change that? I don't think it's just getting rid of the word, because again, like people don't use that word anymore, but they use all sorts of words in place of heathen. So for instance, unreached people groups, frontier people, those are in more religious settings, but in more secular settings, you hear terms like developing countries, the third world, right? Like all of these are terms that are, I argue, euphemisms for heathen, but the ideas still persist. I'm a historian, so that my cop-out answer to that is, well, I just tell the history, and I don't try to make normative claims about what we can do with it, but I would love for the book to get people to think about exactly that question. You know, what can we do with this now that we see this history, see the persistence of the ideas that underlie this concept? You know, we can't just pat ourselves on the back that we don't use this word anymore, because we still continue to do the same things.
Well, this may be redundant, but the last question that I wanted to ask you, and I will anyway, what would you like every reader of this book to take away with them after reading it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that my answer to that would be similar to what I just said, which is, again, to just see that this way of dividing the world into people who are quote unquote right believers and people who are quote unquote wrong believers has not gone away, right, by any means. And I would like people to also take away the significance of religion to processes of racialization in this country, of racial othering, that these are intertwined processes, and that in order to combat racism, we need to look at the religious roots of racism. Right?
Historian Catherine Jen Loom is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Stanford University. Her latest book is titled Religion and Race in American History. Catherine, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.